when it comes to philanthropic giving, of almost $1 trillion that's donated to nonprofits that's spent philanthropically every year, less than 2% goes to initiatives tackling climate change, and less than 2% of that, if we look at TerraSet's own focus area, goes to carbon removal initiatives. So we've got this really strange situation where something that is unarguably a major priority for most people, and where there are amazing things happening, still falls low down that priority list in terms of where people use their philanthropic dollars.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies podcast, where we interview the top climate founders and VCs to get their best advice for you. In this episode, I chat with Adam Frazier, CEO at TerraSet, the anti-GHG 501c3. Philanthropy and climate is a hot topic. Leading up to this episode, I was getting questions left and right about the future of this space. And it's because there's seemingly so much money that could be in the space but isn't yet. That is the exact problem that Adam and TerraSet are trying to solve. It frankly could not have been a more timely show. As always, thanks so much for listening and enjoy the episode. Also, please take a second to fill out our listener survey in the description or our Substack. We're eager to learn more about you, what you do, and how we can help. Now, back to it.
All right, Adam, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, why don't we kick it off? Who are you and what do you do?
I'm Adam Frazier. I'm the CEO of TerraSet, which is a nonprofit which uses philanthropic capital to catalyze permanent carbon removal, or CDR. You'll hear me say CDR again and again, so I'll get that disclaimer in now.
Shout out to our sponsors, Net Zero Insights. Net Zero Insights' mission is to enable the transition to a sustainable future by giving decision makers access to the leading market intelligence platform on climate innovation. Through the Net Zero platform, Net Zero Insights provides high-quality data and insights on the climate tech venture market by being the best at tracking organizations and funding rounds. I personally have had a great time using this to prepare for the podcast and researching companies, funding rounds, VCs, and the latest I need to know about the climate tech ecosystem. Use the link in our description to schedule your personalized demo with the team and claim your 10% discount. Thanks again to the Net Zero Insights team for sponsoring this show. The philanthropic state of climate dollars, I think it's something that's so, so interesting. For some reason, I think leading up to this episode, more people have been talking to me and asking me about this topic in particular. And every time I've mentioned your name, so really appreciate you talking to us at this time. And I think it's going to be a really, really fantastic episode.
Oh, awesome. It's fantastic to be here and appreciate you helping us spread the word about what we're doing and what other people are doing with philanthropic capital and climate, which you're absolutely right, is really important.
Let's start off big. What is the state of philanthropic capital and climate?
You know, if you ask people about the biggest issues facing humanity, climate change scores very highly on that list in most cases, right? We know that some people are not so convinced, but in most cases, climate change is scoring very highly on the list of challenges we're facing. But when it comes to philanthropic giving, of almost $1 trillion that's donated to nonprofits that's spent philanthropically every year, less than 2% goes to initiatives tackling climate change, and less than 2% of that, if we look at TerraSet's own focus area, goes to carbon removal initiatives. So we've got this really strange situation where something that is unarguably a major priority for most people, and where there are amazing things happening, still falls low down that priority list in terms of where people use their philanthropic dollars. So I would say we see philanthropic capital in climate as absolutely pivotal, but also underutilized. And that's really the story of how TerraSet came into being, because there wasn't a way to use philanthropic capital to drive carbon removal. And it seems like such a simple idea that I'm amazed that it didn't exist before. But now that it's come to market, now that we've been doing this for something over a year, it seems to be proving that trend that if there are more avenues for this, you can start to move that delta.
Before we blow everyone's minds with what you do, let's walk it back a little bit and also set the scene. If I'm a philanthropist and I'm looking at my array of causes, why am I choosing not to invest in climate?
I don't know. I think it's a very interesting question. I think it's one of those areas that, depending on whether as a philanthropist you are someone spending millions of dollars on this space, or you're someone who's spending $10 a month on a cause that you really care about, a lot of people look at climate change as almost someone else's responsibility to fix. You think this is something where government will figure it out. This is something where clean energy will fix things. This is something where fossil fuel companies will change what they're doing. We'll all change behavior. And it's not something really that people think, where can my dollars make a difference philanthropically? I think that's probably less true with some nature-based causes. I think, you know, people do support amazing nature-based and conservation organizations. But in terms of actually thinking of, we want fewer greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, it's not something that leaps to mind. And I think probably you can scale that across other climate issues, that it's one of those areas people know is critical, but they don't feel personally responsible for. If you flip that on its head, what's exciting is if you give people a way to be personally responsible for that, then that's empowering. That's something where they think, actually, I can make a difference here, and I can do something about this issue that otherwise is just causing, you know, immense anxiety and worry about the state of the future world, but actually something that you can make a difference in this field, even if you don't work in climate tech, even if you're not, you know, devoting your whole life to trying to solve this problem, even if it's at $10 a month, like, yeah, there are things you can do to make a difference.
Definitely. And I think in talking to a lot of the people that I know within philanthropy, I do some work at the Schmidt Futures Foundation, so I'm very keyed into a lot of these topics. It's a foundation that's particularly focused on science and climate. So I think you can see a good contrast between them and other philanthropies. It's very interesting how there are certain philanthropies that look at supporting topics that have been, you know, areas of interest for philanthropy: benefits access, education, social welfare for social mobility. These are all types of areas that have naturally received lots of philanthropic capital. I think what you're saying also falls into the line of people might look at climate and climate tech and think that the private markets are going to solve it, and there's enough private market activity that philanthropic dollars don't really need to enter. Is that an accurate assessment of the mentality, or is there something else about kind of taking care of itself that you were mentioning?
No, I think you're right. I think that's the accurate thing. And listen, I want to be always very careful with this, because you've just mentioned some absolutely critical, really important causes that people are supporting. Like, I never want to sit here and say, stop giving money to this crucial education cause because we need it in climate change, we need it in carbon removal. Except that you can make that case for any cause, and you can make a case that there should be additional support, whatever the issue. And this issue is just so pressing and so current. And the answers are, to some degree, there, but we need to be moving on them a lot faster. We need to be moving on them now. We need to be driving more capital in that. I really feel the next couple of years are just such a critical time for this space, that it is the time to, you know, I want to say double down, but it's way beyond doubling. We need to scale at a huge pace and a huge rate.
Right. And I think this also coincides with a new generation of philanthropies, if you will. Around 2013, the Science Philanthropy Alliance launched, and this composes a lot of the big funders in the space now. You have the Schmidt Futures Group, but you also have CZI, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, as well as a bunch of other different philanthropies that are now being known as for their innovative arms and the way they fund science and climate science. I think that's a very interesting dynamic, where things that I've been hearing especially are that these different philanthropies are looking at climate science, and they're taking certain projects that they care about, funding that, but also way more radical to let those projects go and now move on to other things where they feel like they can make an outsized difference. And to my understanding, that's a major difference from philanthropies that have been around for much, much longer. Are you seeing this in your experiences, or is it not quite as differentiated?
I think that's true. I think that people have started to think of very innovative ways that you can use philanthropic capital to help not just address something at a kind of a small programmatic level, or even a huge systems-based level that, you know, people like the Gates Foundation and others do, like the amazing work that philanthropy does has often been incredibly innovative. But I think that you're right that there is this new creativity, new understanding of ways that a 501c3 or, you know, corresponding organization in other countries can have a huge impact and maybe be looking to do that in a different way. And you know, sometimes these things are venture philanthropy or impact investing, all these different ways where the world intersects around, like, okay, how can I use my business to drive positive social change? How can I innovate in my philanthropy? You know, these things all cross over in the mind of some very, very intelligent people wanting to make a difference. And what you get is some quite creative solutions.
I think that's definitely representative of the different varied interests and how you manage that. Let's get into your work specifically. Let's have our minds blown a little bit. So I think the most interesting thing that is probably contrarian for a reason, you call yourself anti-GHG. What is that?
So being anti-GHG, being anti-greenhouse gas, it really reflects that commitment to solving this issue that everyone knows about. Greenhouse gases are a major contributing factor to climate change. You know, that's been scientifically established for a long time. It continues to be proven. It continues to be an issue that gets more challenging. And we really just, as TerraSet, wanted to start plugging the gap that exists there on the, as I said before, the more proactive side of that. So we never think for a second that carbon removal, and we'll come on to talk about that in some more detail, but we never think for a second that carbon removal is going to solve everything, that we don't need to change behavior, don't need to address some of the issues I spoke about before with fossil fuels, etc. Like 90%, way above 90% of the change that needs to happen in terms of greenhouse gas emissions is in reducing emissions, it's in changing behavior. But we need to move to the point that we have 5 to 10 billion tons of CO2 or CO2 equivalents removed every year by 2050, according to the IPCC, you know, UN estimates. I suspect, I always feel silly saying this because I certainly have no better idea than the many great scientists involved in things like the IPCC, but I suspect those numbers will turn out to be on the low side, even in a best case scenario. And carbon removal has to be a key part of the balanced equation that leads to us having a sustainable planet. As I say, it needs to scale so dramatically that it needs all sorts of forms of capital coming to it. And that was really where TerraSet came from, as a way of driving philanthropic capital as a catalytic tool to help scale the CDR market.
I think this is a really, really interesting point, not only for the actual technology that you're trying to promote, which is actual carbon capture, you know, establishing that there's a dearth of it in the market. There's also a quality issue in the market. And there's an active conversation. You brought up nature-based carbon solutions, carbon capture solutions, and I wish I could have dived into it then, but bringing that to the forefront now, that is a topic that people have likened to oil commodities, where not every carbon credit and not every capture technology is created equal. And the only way that capture technologies will ever better themselves is when you get those what are called out-of-market solutions in market. And a lot of times, those are not financially viable for your traditional private venture investment. And so what you look to philanthropic capital for is bringing a lot of these out-of-market carbon capture solutions into the fray, where you can get project finance, where you can get private investment to push them forward. I'm curious, do you think of your role in the philanthropic space for CDRs similarly, or are you coming at it from a different angle?
I think we think of it very similarly. So the model that TerraSet uses, the model that we've kind of built ourselves onto this point, is in purchasing tons of removals from innovative CDR companies that are somewhere along that scale, from somewhere along that journey from startup to scale. They're at different points and there are more and more emerging, but there are not enough. There need to be more and they need to be bigger. And as you say, there are a number of financial challenges to the establishment of any company in any field, but in this field, there's tech risk, there's securing project financing, there's capital expenditure, there's all sorts of challenges. When we purchase tons of removals from those companies, we not only move capital to them, and we not only give them that capital to remove tons of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, which is what we exist to do, but we also take on the catalytic effect that you spoke about, because they can use that to point to customer demand, which can be crucial in securing project financing, or it can be crucial in closing a round of investment. So I have anecdotally been told by companies we're working with, companies we're talking to, that, you know, just having this conversation helps move us forward with other sources of financing as well. And then that's really exciting to me, because that's where your money can do, you know, far more than the dollar value would suggest, but can really have an amplifying effect.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's quite fascinating to understand your role there and just actually buying from these solutions rather than investing in them, hoping that there's somebody on the other side. So I like that. I guess the thing that stands out to me is there's like, I want to understand, how did you end up getting into this? Like, what's your story of going from kind of journalism into philanthropy and eventually into climate?
Yeah, great question. It's been a great journey. Speaking as the person who's, you know, experienced it was never a planned journey at any stage. I left college really wanting to be a writer. I loved sport and I loved writing. And so I started working as a sports journalist, and it was just as much fun as I expected it to be. And also I learned a huge amount. Journalism is one of those professions that demands quite rigorous standards when it's done well, and you learn to hold yourself to a high standard. I also found myself interested more and more in the business behind sport versus what was happening on the field. So I started writing more and more about the business of sport and started doing that full time, and tied into that, just emerging at that point, was really the social impact of sport, which has become, you know, over the last 15 years, something that's way more common, the positive impact that sport can have in the world, that athletes can have, that teams can have, brands use in their purpose marketing. And that journey kind of continued for me to the point that I was doing more and more in the social impact space around sport. And then around 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, had the chance to move full time into that field with the Laureus Sport for Good Foundation, which is an amazing organization, founded under the patronage of Nelson Mandela after the role he saw sport play rebuilding post-apartheid South Africa. And it uses sport as a tool for education, for employability, gender equity, racial equity, all sorts of critical issues working in 50 plus countries around the world. And I was the fundraising lead for the organization. Then I was lucky enough to be the chief executive. And, you know, that decade working full time in the philanthropic space really has been, you know, one of those pivotal moments in my career, and where I've just thought, this is somewhere where I can make a difference. When I had the opportunity to come to TerraSet and move full time into climate, you know, it was a wrench in terms of leaving a role that I absolutely loved, but it was really exciting because of the potential that I feel like this organization has, and the challenge that's ahead of it. You know, something I've said before is, imagine 20 years from now wishing that you tried to make more of a difference in this field and you didn't. And that's why I think it's such a privilege, and I'm sure you both agree, and I'm sure many of your other guests would as well, and listeners, such a privilege to be working in this space because it's so important, because the challenge is so big. And so when the opportunity came up to take what I knew about scaling a nonprofit, raising funds, being impactful, you know, building a team to do that, the opportunity was just too good to turn down. And the people behind TerraSet, the founders, the people who make up my board now, are just incredible people who are driven and committed to this challenge and have brought this to life. And I feel very lucky to have been, you know, tasked and entrusted with a part in scaling it.
What I'm curious about always is, what did you learn in your past experience in the non-climate world that really translates well into and that you use a lot in kind of the work in philanthropy, at the intersection of philanthropy and climate?
So it's a really good question. Couple of things, I guess I would say. One is doing things right. You know, I've spoken a lot already in this conversation about the need to do things fast. And that is important, right? We need to be willing to try things and fail. But we also need to make sure that we're really learning as we go and that we are minimizing those failures where we can. And that's something that, you know, my time at Laureus was a really good grounding in that, because we were entrusted with funding from some major brands, from some high-profile individuals. We worked with a lot of the world's biggest athletes. And that means that they are putting their reputation on the line to an extent in working with you. Like, you are representative of them as well. Samuel, you talk about your work with the Schmidt Futures Foundation, right? That there are names involved in that, of families, of individuals that they want to be known for doing good work. And it's the same with your ambassadors, with your board members. So making sure that we live up to the trust that's placed in us by people donating. You know, that we said before, all the amazing things, all the important things people can donate their philanthropic capital to. Like, we need to make sure that anyone who's donated to us thinks that was a good decision. I think the other thing is maybe more from the journalism side, and that's storytelling. I think that there's a huge amount of storytelling that still needs to happen in the carbon removal space. There are a lot of misunderstandings of exactly how it is. There's a lot of gray area around it. You know, what's carbon removal? What's carbon capture? Where are we avoiding or mitigating or reducing? That's not something that I think the general public are necessarily aware of, those nuances. And we need to figure out to what level they need to be aware of it and tell that more compelling story. I said before, it's amazing to see the journey sport has gone on over the last 15 years or so in realizing it can be a force for social change, and a big part of that has been storytelling. And I think the lessons from that can come to this space will be really valuable as well.
Yeah, the point of doing it right is something I think is kind of underrated in a lot of things. I mean, if you really think about it, there's been bad actors in climate, and I think that everybody could really stand to think about the responsibility they have if they've raised any money from anybody, right? Like, take total ownership of what you're doing and do it extremely well and persevere, because there's a lot of people who are just, you know, they might be jumping in because it's, hey, I want to make a difference, but they may not have that resolve to really make it happen. And just think about, you know, who are they doing it for? It's not just for themselves. It's also for the whole planet. And in particular for the people who've invested in them. Right. So I think that's a really interesting point you bring up that I think a lot of people could benefit from.
I think one unique perspective that you probably do bring is you come from a non-climate background, so to speak, and now you're in climate. You're also able to look at it from that way. Funders, when they look at putting philanthropic dollars towards a cause, a lot of them didn't come from climate, right? So they genuinely have to align how climate fits into their priorities. And honestly, I found it really interesting that they call it their portfolio of investment solutions across philanthropic dollars. How do you think your skills coming from non-climate to climate help you communicate what you do to funders who have priorities outside of climate?
As I touched on before, I think a big part of what we're doing is almost democratizing that access, because, as I say, this can be around $10 a month. But even when it's hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, giving people a way that they can make a difference. And this didn't exist before. You could hypothetically go as an individual and find a way to purchase carbon removal from an organization and figure out a way that you were going to do your due diligence around that, and figure out a process and negotiate a contract and do some work like that. And there are some of the more established organizations in the space, like Climeworks, who have different models where you can, as an individual, purchase from. But to be able to have that in one place where the due diligence is good and built on the knowledge that exists in the sector, you know, we're not trying to build a huge team of researchers. We want to capitalize on what's already there. And to be able to get a tax receipt for that, you know, donations to TerraSet were a 501c3. They're tax deductible, which means that can benefit, you know, you as an individual donating, but it also means your money can go further in this critical area. And so telling that story of like, okay, if this is something you want to make a difference on, this is why philanthropic capital is so important at this point. This is where in some ways it can do more than other forms of capital. This is where it can unlock other forms of capital. And a lot of the people that we're talking to who have built successful businesses, or they lead other innovative organizations, you know, I think they are attracted to that as well. They're attracted to the fact that they can really see the difference that they're making mapped out over the next few years to really address this issue. I think it's a really powerful combination of the desire people have to make a difference in this space, and also the desire they have, or the enthusiasm they have for catalyzing something, for building something and being part of helping something scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you answered one of the questions we have, which is, you know, why did you choose to make it a nonprofit versus doing it as a for-profit entity? But it sounds like you've answered that, right? People have an opportunity to donate and make it a tax-deductible donation. But I wanted to go back and just kind of summarize to get this correct, that you are philanthropy that invests in not the companies, but you buy the carbon removal from the organization. So, and can you just clarify for people, you had mentioned earlier, you know, nobody was doing that before. So why does it matter that you're doing that, obviously, besides being the first person to do it? But can you just kind of clarify this whole point for us so people understand what exactly your role is here?
Yeah, it's something that, you know, you say we were the first to do it and others will and maybe are starting to, and we really welcome that. You know, it's the great thing about this work, and I found this with the climate space as a whole, is not being protective and trying to say, no, we own this piece of the puzzle, but really welcoming people coming in different ways and making a difference. The TerraSet model is that donations to us are tax deductible. We don't give a donor credits in the way that they're not purchasing credits from us. They're making a donation to us as a nonprofit. We use that capital to purchase the removal of tons of greenhouse gases from the companies in our portfolio. Those companies have been assessed against our criteria, which take in metrics across areas like being additional, verifiable, long-term, ethical, scalable, validated, catalytic. We then build partnerships and purchase agreements with the organizations that that pass that due diligence and that we have the funding to support. And that's an important point, because with more funding, we could support more organizations. There are more people coming to us for funding than we have the capital to support at this point. And hopefully that never stops, because that will mean there are more and more companies coming into the space. But we use it to purchase from them, and that's revenue for them. And that's really critical, because they are securing venture capital from somewhere else. So they're securing, you know, different stages of investment. Maybe there are ways they can be getting support for capital expenditure from either the IRA, from different opportunities or other sources. But revenue is key to the growth of any successful business at some point. And being able to look at revenue is a vital part of securing other capital. I think the model that Alex and Chris and the team who originally came up with this concept with is based on how areas like solar power have also scaled, and the different agreements that can be built to say, like, when this is available, when you have done this, yes, we will purchase. You know, that unlocks more money. That lets people that lets people build. And so that's a key part of what we're doing. I'll say, I don't want to, complicate our narrative. I think it's really good that we have a simple narrative of like, here's what we'll do with this money. Here's why it makes a difference. But we always ask companies, like, what else could we do? What other ways are there we could support you? What would be most powerful? You know, we're only something over a year old. So we still absolutely consider ourselves learning. And I hope we never lose that learning mindset. But at this point, we certainly have it. And we always ask them, what could we do differently? Generally, the answer at this point is this is what they need, that revenue is really, really key mm-hmm. to helping them scale.
And the goal, again, just to clarify for everybody, despite it being philanthropy, the goal is that it's helping them refine their processes so they can kind of work through and make the cost of capture lower in the future, just like it costs less to build a solar panel now than it did in the past. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's a great clarification. That's exactly right. You know, one of the challenges this sector faces is that removing a ton of carbon is too expensive right now. The magic number people talk about in this space is getting that down to below $100 per ton. Other people are more ambitious with that. But once you get it to $100 per ton and you're thinking, okay, maybe it's 5 billion or 10 billion tons a year needed, you know, you're looking at $500 billion to $1 trillion there. Like, that's a huge number, but at a macroeconomic scale, it's an understandable number when you compare it to equivalents. And hopefully, you know, that number that we ultimately need to remove could actually come down. Hopefully the cost can come down further. But it's really important that we and other people putting money into this space right now are really focused on what the companies themselves are focused on is finding a way to move that number down so that the sector becomes more attractive and more scalable.
Yeah, and what I find interesting is the model here. So can you talk about this, broadly speaking, with philanthropy? When people grow the amount of money they have to administer, usually there's a lot of, you got to hire more people to administer that money, and it just kind of gets more complicated. But if I understand correctly, what you're doing is relatively scalable. So can you just speak about that, the efficiency of the capital and the scalability of what you're doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have to check myself here, because what I don't want to do is say that it is a positive thing for nonprofits to run themselves at too cheap a number. Make it. Everyone wants nonprofits to be incredibly well-run organizations, and yet at the same time, then say, "Oh, but we don't want them spending money on being a well-run organization." So I always want to be very careful about not sounding like I'm saying like 100% of everything you raise should only go to this cause. What we have with TerraSet, though, is a very scalable model. It doesn't mean that there's a huge need to grow a huge team, because all of these companies and the companies that we would also like to be purchasing from have capacity for scale. If we can purchase 100 tons from an organization, or 1,000 tons from an organization, or 10,000 tons from an organization, the process is the same in terms of the due diligence we want to do, in terms of understanding how they're going to deliver that, when they're going to deliver that. And so us having more money does not equate to needing more staff. They're not a direct equivalent, at least. So as we scale, we firmly believe that we will be more efficient, in the same way as we firmly believe as the sector scales, it will be more efficient, and the cost of doing the work will in some ways be cheaper, or relatively speaking, cheaper.
What do you think is the main confusion when it comes to the CDR landscape? I think this is a topic that is both very, very clear to those who understand the space, because it's sort of one of the main things that became mainstream for climate early on. But now, I think there's a lot of confusion about what direction do not only CDR technologies, but carbon credits on top of them. And I think your perspective in evaluating these technologies is incredibly useful. So I want to ask two things. The first is, what does the landscape look like? And the second is, how do you think about evaluating them?
That's a really good question as to where the confusion, what the confusion is as well. I think the landscape is exciting. There's a lot happening. There are new companies launching. There are innovative ideas happening. There are different people putting funding towards this space from different sources. So it's moving fast. In a way, that makes it more confusing if you're on the outside. And I think that's something we always try to remind ourselves, is we are on the inside of this. We talk about carbon removal all the time. And we talk to a lot of people who talk about carbon removal all the time. And even when we're educating people about it, you know, they're people with a desire to start doing more work in this space and to understand it. And so there's a buy-in there. If you move out to all the people that we want to be interested in CDR, who maybe know nothing or very little about it, all they maybe see about the entire space as a whole is an article somewhere about carbon credits not being delivered, or, you know, companies not doing what they've said they'll do, organizations not doing what they've said they'll do. And I think that's a real challenge, because that can mean that if the confidence isn't there, people will do one of two things. They'll either stop donating or stop investing, or they'll try and find a way to make sure that there's a, you know, more of a flight to quality. And that's certainly something that we see CDR as being able to provide. You know, this is not about cheap offsets that never get delivered. This is really about trying to find very, very tangible, measurable, impactful ways of taking greenhouse gases out of the air and making sure that that happens.
Right. What's a CDR technology that has caught your eye recently?
We have a portfolio that's probably a little heavy percentage-wise in direct air capture. We've been very agnostic in our methodologies. As I've said, we're assessing against those criteria I mentioned before: additional, scalable, ethical, etc. When we went through building our portfolio to its current point, that's meant that quite a few direct air capture companies have come through. To summarize this for anyone who doesn't know, and without ever pretending to be a climate scientist, and my explanation won't give anyone the wrong impression of that, you know, direct air capture is using a giant fan, to take the cliche, although there's innovations around that, to suck in air, pass it across or through a solvent or sorbent, which then binds the relevant molecules and gives you something that can be stored or utilized and releases the other air. We have a number of organizations doing that in our portfolio. We're also very excited by, you know, all the other technologies in the space. Enhanced rock weathering, I love, because to me it bridges that gap between nature-based and engineered solutions that I think is a somewhat artificial gap we've created. All of these technologies are basically just taking natural processes and accelerating them or learning from them. They're just things that happen anyway, you know, in science, in the world. At some point in nature, CO2 molecules react with molecules in the ground and form calcium carbonate, limestone, and that's something that we, you know, that happens at a geological scale. Enhanced rock weathering is just trying to speed that up, and I really like that as a way that I think people who are not so sure about the tech side of things, but maybe they really, you know, they believe in the natural world as we do, really see the really can sort of see that it's an artificial line we're drawing between those areas. I think the final thing I would say on it is I really love the co-benefits we see. So we are focused on removing greenhouse gases. Like that is the you know, the core part of the mission. But we're also very interested in the co-benefits that come with this space. And so we have organizations in our portfolio like Octavia Carbon, who are driving job creation and livelihoods in East Africa. We have organizations like Capture Six, whose process involves the creation of drinkable, potable water from brine. We have, you know, organizations like Andes, who rely on capturing carbon in soil, which improves the quality of the soil, which improves crop yield, which, you know, you see here each of the co-benefits also starting to address another problem we talk about in climate. And that's what really excites me about the climate space as a whole. You know, as I've come into it, you just see all of these areas that actually multiple problems kind of have one solution, or they can become each other's solution if we can get the right things lined up. And that's what really excites me.
Yeah, I think the idea of co-benefits is quite interesting. I wonder if there's ever going to be a way to try to help price some of these things in, because maybe other people can help pay for something if there is a co-benefit, but they're not paying for the full removal, you know, to try to reduce the prices. I'd be curious to see if that happens. And by the way, we have had Carbon Capture 6 on our show, so nice to see the stars aligning there. I guess I'm really curious about who can invest in this, because, or who can kind of give to this initiative, because we didn't talk about how you're funded and who can give. I want to understand the profile of who might be willing to or able to donate.
I mean, really anyone. As I say, we are very interested in the democratization of access to this space. So we have people who are donating $10 on our website, either as a one-off donation or monthly. And that's really important, and we want more of those people. And then we have individuals who are able to donate a much larger amount. Some of them, you know, high profile individuals. So Tim Ferriss is a donor of ours. That's amazing because of his, you know, contribution to our work. And it's also amazing because his profile clearly is something that helps us tell this story and that people connect with. And then in a similar way, you know, we receive funding from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, from Conscience Bay Research. We are an accredited nonprofit in the 1% for the Planet movement. So all of those areas are also important in terms of the finances, but the credibility of this space is really key as well. In terms of future donor profile and scaling that, as I say, it's all important. I think that there are the people I talk to almost fall into two lanes at the moment. And they are people, lane one is people who just want to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. This is a way to do it. This is a way they understand. It's tax deductible. It's all the things that we've spoken about. And then the second is people who say, oh, wow, you're onto something here and helping TerraSet scale and be able to do this more efficiently will then have a positive effect on the sector scaling. And they're the people who are more into the idea of like being part of helping to build something. All of that's equally important, whatever level it's at. You know, you need as a nonprofit a diverse funding base so that you're not just reliant on one donor who might one day go away, or if the market shifts, if things go wrong with a particular part of the market, that you're not suddenly missing a huge, huge chunk of your budget. The wider base you have, the more resilient you are.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that overall like perspective on how to engage people and how to engage in this space is sort of a skill set and a mindset that is not very common. One way I like to think about it is back when venture was first introduced, I mean, venture is called an alternative asset, right? Alternative investing. So it's definitionally on the side of what you were normally used to. I think the way in which you do this sort of, it's not a financing model, right? Because you're essentially putting in philanthropic dollars, not for necessarily any financial returns. You can't really call it that. But I'm curious, people, when they look at the kind of way that you go about this, when I look at it, I think it's very, very unique. So I'm wondering about the genesis of the whole thing. Honestly, I feel like all the way through, we've talked about it in a lot of different ways, but we haven't specifically said, I feel like this is a pretty unique way of going about this that I haven't really seen before. So where did the idea of doing this exact way of aggregating from an economic perspective come from? Was it a conversation? Was it a research paper? Where did that come from?
I'm always wary about speaking about conversations I wasn't in. But at the same time, I agree with you. I think it's very innovative, but I also think it's very simple. And if you talk to Alex Retta, who was the founder of TerraSet, is the founder of TerraSet, and Chris Wedding, who's the co-founder, both on our board, and the others who were involved in those early conversations, they almost couldn't believe this didn't exist. They were just looking for a way to do what we're now doing. They said, hey, I'd like to put some philanthropic capital into carbon removal. Where can I do that? And couldn't find it, and kept searching for it and still couldn't find it, and talked to a lot of people in the space because they're involved in the climate space and in investments and in doing, you know, different things, both from a business perspective, an academic perspective, etc. And couldn't find a way of doing this. And in the end, reached the point they said, okay, we need to create this then. And it's funny how many of our donors have almost, you know, come to us in the same way. I've had just messages from people which say, I've been looking for something like this and was worrying I might have to found it myself. So I'm really glad that TerraSet exists. And that's the start of our relationship with them. And I think that in itself tells a really positive story about the desire that people have to be making a difference in this space and the reason that we exist. I think, as I say, it's not a defendable idea at all. Someone else could start doing this tomorrow. Someone else could launch a nonprofit and look to raise capital and purchase carbon removal with it. And I would think that was absolutely wonderful. I think they probably would be being somewhat duplicative, and I'd be like, hey, help us and we'll do that. But I'd welcome it. Like, if anything they were doing that drove more capital into this space would be a really positive thing. And the genesis of TerraSet was really that vehicle, that route didn't exist.
It's just interesting. Definitely. That you don't really need to compete, right? Because if you're not competing for some kind of returns, there is no competition. And especially if you're effective at it, then why bother like duplicating it, right? So I think that's quite a fascinating facet.
I wonder, on that angle, do you really think, I mean, one thing that I think is relevant within philanthropies is you are competing for a quote-unquote finite amount of dollars. I mean, I've been speaking to people, some people who say there's infinite amount of money available. Some people say there's no money available. You know, factually, there's definitely a limit. But even within the funders that you're speaking of, you're often competing against other causes. So I'm curious, does it really feel like there's no competition? Or realistically, are you just aware that if you pitch yourself in a certain way, you might succeed?
It's a good question. Everyone has a budget. Every you know, philanthropic organization, every individual who's donating, everyone has some level of budget, something they commit to this work every year. So you're right that you're always trying to make sure you sit somewhere on that priority list versus another cause. But equally, there's a huge amount of capital in this space just looking at, say, the amount of money tied up in donor-advised funds that's not currently being used. It's been donated to donor-advised funds, and it's kind of sitting there for future philanthropic use. And you can look at different ways that's the case in different parts of the philanthropic spectrum. And I think unlocking some of that comes back to a point I made before about the time being now. That, you know, a ton of carbon removed today is more valuable than a ton of carbon removed down the line because of everything that we've spoken about in terms of helping organizations scale, in terms of, you know, the impact being as something that needs to happen as quickly as possible. And so I think that, yes, while you're right, there's a finite pool to some extent, increasing the size of that pool is something that that can happen. The capacity is there.
What are these donor advised funds waiting on, do you think?
I think it's something that people see as a way they can have a positive impact in the world. Like, I want to be very, very careful. Like, people do amazing good through donor advised funds. So I'm not suggesting that people just park their money in a donor advised fund and never do anything with it. Like, incredibly powerful things happen from donor advised funds. But I think people also think, I want to be able to have a legacy for the long term. Like, this is money that I want to put to philanthropic use. Maybe over the next 20 years, maybe over the next 30 years. Like, we would call that sustainable planning in any aspect of business. So I'm not criticizing that. Like, everyone should be thinking about, like, here's what I'm doing today. Here's what I feel I want to be able to do tomorrow. Here's where I want to continue commitments that I might make today for many years. And so I need to make sure the resources are there for that. But I think when you work in a field that's so predicated on growth now, that's when you think, if we could just put some more of that money to work right now, then that would be hugely impactful.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. There's so many fascinating things. One thing that you said just a little while ago, I wanted to make sure I re-highlight to the audience, which is, because you kind of went through it quickly, is the time value of carbon, right? And that a carbon removed today is more valuable than later because things are keep getting hotter. So I just wanted to really highlight that to people. And it's also part of the reason why I think this whole idea is fascinating, that yes, it is more expensive to remove carbon right now, but it's also more important that we actually do it, right? And get it done. I guess just to kind of get, as we get to the end here, I want to understand, what are you, you know, how do you look at the future? Are you pretty optimistic about like how things are going? What is your outlook?
More optimistic than I was before I was working in climate, you know, as someone who's still in their first year in this field, seeing the amazing things people are doing. You know, you guys are lucky enough to talk to them all the time on this show, but hearing the amazing innovators, the entrepreneurs, the passionate people who are devoting their lives and their resources and their talent to trying to solve this problem leaves me really optimistic. At the same time, it's very scary. Like it's all the answers are there, but it's a time crunch. Like we need this to happen faster than it is. And so there's a real mix of optimism and also urgency. And I think that those two things can come together to be a really powerful force. And as I said, I hope that we all look back in 20 years and we think how lucky we were to be part of solving this problem. Even if we're, you know, not quite able to think of it in those fortunate terms, I think we'll all think it was the right thing to have been trying. And I think that the answers are there and we can get there. We just need to keep pushing.
Right. And better now than never, right? So again, Adam, thank you so much for coming on. This was a super timely show. The time snuck up on us and we didn't really realize. Before we close out, where can the audience find you?
You can visit our website, which is terrasetclimate.org. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can, you know, find us on different platforms. You can send us an email, hello@terrasetclimate.org. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to talk to you more about what we're doing and how you can be involved.
And I think you definitely put your money behind that. I was just thinking earlier today, not many guests put their emails in their call to action. So thank you for giving the audience that. Thanks so much for Adam for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you both. Real pleasure.